We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day. Oh, and you want the proof? Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Audacy put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Audacy. Visit ads.audacy.com.
So if I were to ask you what happened on this date in history, January 17th, I'm sure not a lot of people could answer that. January 17th, 100 years ago. Yeah, I'm not sure that a lot of folks would know. If I gave you a hint and said it had something to do with dry, would that mean anything to you? Well, believe it or not, 100 years ago, America went dry. Yes, it went dry. And it's a story we don't hear enough about, but it is a story of prohibition. And Leslie Sibilic is, I don't know, she's kind of an expert on this subject, in large part because she is a senior curator at the Heinz History Center, and she was the lead curator on an exhibition at the Heinz History Center last year on American Spirits, the Rise and Fall of Prohibition. Welcome to the show. Welcome to the Disc Institute of Pittsburgh Newsline.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
So I'm guessing, you know, prohibition, I think that's something that everybody kind of knows the word, but we don't necessarily know a lot about the history of it.
You know, it is one of those time periods in American history that has these great vivid images, bathtub gin, flappers. But you're right, we have these really great kind of pictures in our head, and then the reality is so much more complicated. It's one of those, can you really believe they did that situations?
So what is the backstory? I mean, how did we get to that point in history?
Well, prohibition was a long time in coming. I think the one thing that people really forget is by the time January 17th, 1920 came, you had been fighting prohibition for almost 100 years in this country. I mean, I think the earliest I found in Pittsburgh, for example, was in 1829. About 1,000 people actually signed a petition saying that there were too many saloons, too many taverns in Pittsburgh. So from the 1820s on, there were efforts back and forth in this country to limit the amount of drinking. Americans were really big drinkers. And so this effort came in waves, and sometimes it got a state or two to actually declare that they were dry, but nothing really worked. And then in the early 1900s, you had a couple specific groups, the Women's Christian Temperance Union, and most importantly, the Anti-Saloon League. The Anti-Saloon League is this great example of a group that they made one mission their political cause, and they said, we don't care what else you stand for as long as you stand with us in terms of shutting down the saloon, and their timing was perfect. You have this buildup in Europe. You have World War I looming. There's a lot of anti-immigrant feeling in America, and they use that to their advantage. I mean, a lot of the Anti-Saloon League propaganda related to the beer industry, Germans, things like that, and eventually they created a voting bloc where state by state by state they got this passed, and their political strategy to do so was to get that amendment and then literally get it passed state by state by state until they got enough to see it go through.
Now, it's kind of interesting. I mean, when we say, and even when you say that we were big drinkers, do we have any idea what alcohol consumption then, how it would compare to alcohol consumption in 2020?
Well, you know, it's funny because one of the things that prohibition did do very well was it did help in actually limiting, at least for a while, the amount of drinking. So, and I think maybe it, if I'm getting my statistics right, I think finally the numbers got back up to near what it was within recent times. But if you're talking back in the 1880s, 1870s, even earlier, it was this incredibly high number. I mean, 7 gallons of pure alcohol for every American is kind of what the estimate was for about 1830. 7 gallons.
7 gallons of pure alcohol.
That equals to about 90 bottles per average American. And some of that, to be fair, you know, people drank differently than we do now. Some of that was diluted with water. People got up in the morning and they had whiskey with water. They drank hard cider. So it maybe wasn't quite what we're envisioning with here's your straight whiskey in a glass, but mm-hmm. it was still an incredibly large amount of alcohol, and even Europeans commented on it.
And it was also a different culture. It was a different climate.
The whole thing was different. I mean, people weren't necessarily used to even thinking about drinking water. For much of that time, water wasn't safe to drink. You have some groups coming in where their tradition was to drink alcohol. I mean, not everybody really had a tradition of drinking milk and other things. And so it was built into the culture, and then it became this thing where, you know, when you got up in the morning, you took a drink. When you had a break at work, you took a drink. I mean, the military had whether it's the Army or the Navy, they had rations for whiskey and rum. And those kind of things just led into a culture that drank a lot, had a high tolerance level, but nonetheless was really notably healthy in their alcohol intake, even so that, as I said, you know, there's some famous examples where Europeans are writing back to people in their own countries and saying, oh my gosh, I can't believe how much those Americans drink.
Now, when we went dry, we went dry?
Well, that depended on where you were drinking.
Okay.
The catch with Prohibition is that it never really banned drinking alcohol. It banned the manufacture, transportation, and sale of it. So even with Prohibition, people had a year's notice. They knew it was coming. So if you had a stash of alcohol in your house and you drank it and you shared it with your friends who are in your house, technically that wasn't illegal. You couldn't sell it. You couldn't make it to sell. The catch is that, of course, not everybody could stockpile so much alcohol that it was mm-hmm. simply at their disposal. So one of the big charges against Prohibition became that it penalized certain groups more than others. If you were a private club or a wealthy citizen who could stock up multiple years worth of whiskey and wine, you weathered Prohibition pretty well.
Yeah.
If you were that person who you made beer and maybe you sold a little bit to your neighbors or you did your own distilling and you shared that with people in your community, that's where there was a heavier impact on it.
We're talking Prohibition. I mean, I don't know how much you know about it, and I don't know if you know why this date is so important, but we are thankful to Leslie Sibilic from the Heinz History Center to bring us up to date, or at least give us the background, because I know two terms. I know Prohibition, and I know speakeasy, and that's about it. Thanks for being with us, Leslie. We'll do another quick segment, then we'll do the news, and you can stick around a little bit longer. Do I have you here? Oh, yep, there you are. You can stick around a little bit longer, correct?
Correct.
All right, so how did we get from Prohibition to speakeasies?
Well, you know, that's a really interesting story in and of itself, because in some ways the term speakeasy really predates Prohibition. But it's also a reminder that in places like Pittsburgh, they had a great kind of warning for what Prohibition could turn into, even by the 1880s. The term speakeasy, and part of this is kind of local lore and part of it is based in reality, the term actually emerged in the 1880s. And there are people, including originally a New York Times correspondent, who related it directly to usage here in kind of the Steel Valley. It was originally connected to a woman who was actually an illegal saloon operator in McKeesport. And while the kind of facts versus the legend of the story are mixed, the piece behind it is that a woman named Kate Hester was running an illegal saloon, and when she was afraid that the noise and the boisterous level of activity in the saloon would attract the wrong kind of attention, she would say, shh, boys, speak easy. And the local legend is that this became the term speakeasy. And in fact, Kate Hester was a real person. What happened is Pittsburgh, and in fact Pennsylvania, in trying to limit the saloons in an earlier time period in the 1880s passed something called the Brooks Law.
Wait, hold that thought, Leslie. We got a break to news. We'll come back. I'll speak easy. We'll take a break for news and be right back. Prohibition. I tell you what, how about this? I never knew what speakeasy. I never knew the backstory on speakeasy, but I love it. Speakeasy. I mean, isn't that like the greatest story? That's just one of the things that we've learned in the last couple of minutes since we've been talking with Leslie Sibilic from the Heinz History Center. We are celebrating 100 years. 100 years. January 17th, 100 years ago. Prohibition. Pennsylvania went dry, but we've come a long way since then. Thanks for holding on, Leslie.
No problem. It's a great topic.
And I'm sorry, I stopped you only because we had to get that break in as we were talking about speakeasies and the backstory on speakeasies, which, as you mentioned, actually predated Prohibition.
It was one of many earlier attempts to kind of encourage Americans to drink less. And yes, 1880s, there are laws passed raising saloon fees. The hope is that most people won't be able to afford it, so they'll simply close. But you know what happens? When people want to drink, they're going to find a way to drink, and they started offering it illegally, and the term came from one of the women who was reportedly running an illegal operation, and in fact, she was a real person, so there is some truth to the story, and then it picks up by the 1920s when prohibition becomes the law of the land. For a lot of people, they just never really regarded it seriously, and also because the law was so uneven, you could drink at home. There were all these loopholes. There were things that were allowed. There were things that weren't allowed. A lot of people had trouble tracking it, and they just never really took it seriously. I mean, in cities like Pittsburgh, there were neighborhoods where it was largely regarded as completely unenforceable.
Well, I would imagine as well, at some point, the government, and I hate to say this, probably recognized too, that it was a good tax revenue stream.
Well, I mean, certainly before Prohibition even officially goes into effect, there were a lot of people, including the entire brewing industry and distilling industry, that couldn't believe they would really make Prohibition the law of the land because it was such a valuable part of the national economy. And there's a whole longer story about how changing the system of certain kind of taxes and the rise of income tax helped win the argument on that end. And then what happens after the stock crash of 1929, the Great Depression emerges, and taxation and revenue is one of the two things that really does eventually lead to the repeal of Prohibition, the other one being the just level of violence that rises because of it.
So I mentioned in your initial introduction that you had curated an exhibit back in 2018 at the John Heinz History Center. Tell me, what was there a popular part of that exhibit for visitors back in 2018?
Yes, and I have to say, we did that in concert with the National Constitution Center out of Philadelphia.
Okay.
Some of it, the original was created by them, and we added local content. But yeah, I have to say, the section in the exhibit that encouraged people to imagine like they were entering a speakeasy, you knock on this door, do you get the right password, and then learning how to do the Charleston, the dances, the costumes, the music, the drinks during that time period was hugely popular. Although the whole thing it really resonated with people. They enjoy the story. They enjoy those very famous images and learning the backstory behind it, too. I mean, it was really a time, especially for women, when everything about the way some women lived changed. I mean, society changed in very dramatic ways beyond just the drinking aspect.
And I would say, I mean, so this is the 100th anniversary. So what should our listeners, what would you, because certainly at this point you are our expert, you know, way more than we do about this. What is it that we should take away on this 100th anniversary today?
You know, I think one of the lessons for me in Prohibition is just how complicated it gets when you try and, in effect, legislate or control behavior, even if that wasn't their total goal and the motives behind it. For the people who were advocating a dry cause, there were very good reasons behind what they were trying to do, but it had such profound unintended consequences. And I think to think through those things and to really understand that when you're trying to control what is kind of a part of people's culture and their behavior, you really don't know all the pieces of what you're getting into.
And do you think, last question, and we certainly appreciate the time you've spent with us today. Do you think, I mean, I look at, we were talking about this earlier this week in terms of civics and the kinds of things our kids are learning about and not learning about in school. Do you think they learn enough about prohibition these days in current curriculums?
You know, I don't know how big that piece figures into the larger curriculum for the, especially the elementary schools, but I think the lessons of prohibition have changed over time,
mm-hmm.
and I think hopefully they learn enough so that they understand the complexity of it. And I think really, for schools, the lesson behind prohibition is the 100-year buildup to what actually became a constitutional amendment, and then what are the factors that eventually led to its repeal. The only time we've ever done that. The history behind that is really crucially important, and the fact that what was it that allowed us to repeal this when certainly there are debates about other amendments, but then nothing along the lines of that. I think that piece of it, the complexities behind what really made the legal, the successful political argument that got prohibition passed, and then what was then the counter argument that eventually led to its fall. I hope that those are lessons that come across very clearly.
Indeed. Leslie Sibilic, thanks so much for joining us today. Great information, great segment. We appreciate you for joining us on the DISC Institute of Pittsburgh Newsline. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you.
All righty, have a great afternoon.
You too.
Who would think a 100th anniversary? You just never know. I love that story about speakeasy. I love that story. I'll probably tell that over and over and over again.
We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day. Oh, and you want the proof? Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Odyssey put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Odyssey. Visit ads.odyssey.com.